This is Philosophy Bites with me, David Edmonds.
And me, Nigel Warburton.
Philosophy Bites is available at www.philosophybites.com.
Philosophy Bites is made in association with the Institute of Philosophy.
We've already had Philosophy Bites interviews about two leading political theorists of the 20th century, who've always been seen as being in opposing camps. In the right corner, Friedrich Hayek, an inspiration to Margaret Thatcher. In the left, John Rawls, who argued that economic breaks for the best off were only justified if they had beneficial effects on the most disadvantaged members of society. But John Tomasi believes we can and should combine elements from both thinkers. The left has rightly stressed that a just society should look after its poorest and that all citizens should have some basic liberties, the liberty of conscience, for example, and the right to vote. But according to Tomasi, there's a set of liberties, economic liberties, which are fundamental to how our lives go and which the left has failed to appreciate.
John Tomasi, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Thank you, Nigel. Happy to be here.
The topic we're going to focus on is free market fairness. We're talking about economic freedoms. A lot of people think there's a fundamental conflict between having a free market of any kind and fairness at all.
Yes, I think many people think that free market fairness is an oxymoron, but I don't think that. I think that free markets are a kind of fairness, that we decide what fairness is not by asking what markets produce, but by having philosophical arguments. And those philosophical arguments result in a standard of evaluation that markets can satisfy.
Are you saying that we have some kind of prior right to exchange goods and so on without constraints, and that trumps everything else?
No, I reject the traditional libertarian idea that property rights can be founded prior to social discussions or democratic deliberation. And rejecting that, I try to instead build up a conception of what I think of as classical liberalism built on democratic foundations. On that conception of property rights, the one that I affirm through democracy, property rights have very heavy weight. They're among the basic rights and liberties of free democratic citizens, but they're not absolutes. So it's not the case that a person can stand on their property rights, in my view, and resist any kind of calls to taxation, for example. Unlike a long tradition of thinkers in the left liberal tradition, I think that economic liberties are intrinsically connected to freedom. I think that the domain of working and activities of ownership protect a kind of self-authorship. Traditionally, liberals thought that property rights were among the most weighty rights and liberties. But starting around 1850 or so with John Stuart Mill, we start to get an important change, a sea change, I think, in liberal thinking. And Mill thought that everyday activities of applying for a job and getting rejected, and applying for a job again and getting rejected again, and going out there again and getting the job this time, going to work, being bossed around, becoming good at your work and therefore getting your raise, starting to save money, thinking about your retirement, the sort of workaday things that working class people do during their lives. Mill thought that that domain of human activity was not essentially connected to liberty. Other people in that tradition, most notably in my opinion, John Maynard Keynes, also thought that economic liberties, those bourgeois virtues of working and saving, were in fact just something that were instrumentally necessary. And so Keynes has this beautiful short essay called Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren. It's written in 1930, a time of economic gloominess. And Keynes says that, you know, within 100 years, he predicts, Western economies will have grown 8 times, which my economist friends tell me is sort of a remarkably prescient estimate on his part. But at that point, by the year 2030, when his grandchildren are alive, roughly where we are now, I suppose, Keynes thought the economic problem would have been solved. And once the economic problem was solved, he thought we could recognize those bourgeois virtues for the vices that they'd always been, the instrumental vices they'd always been. In fact, Keynes describes those everyday libertarian attitudes as morbid neuroses, and he says those people who cling to them should be put in mental institutions. And so too, I think, John Rawls picks up that same line. He's working in that same general line. And in 1971, in A Theory of Justice, he sets out a list of basic rights and liberties that includes only 2 extremely thin, narrow, attenuated economic liberties, a right to own personal property, but not productive property, and a basic right to freedom of occupational choice, that is, to choose which occupation you do, but not to be able to choose the terms on which you do your work.
So what you're saying is that there's this long history of liberalism which focuses on other kinds of freedom than economic freedom. It foregrounds freedom of expression, freedom of choice of lifestyle, freedom of association, but neglects what you see as a freedom of economic exchange and property owning. But you're saying that economic freedom is actually part of the good life, as it were.
I think that's right. The fact that the classical liberal economists tended to be consequentialists in their justifications for economic liberty has led people to think that the only justification or a primary justification would be in terms of consequentialism, that is, in terms of economic efficiency. And the alternative on the horizon was the only one we've had philosophically, recently at least, has been a kind of property rights absolutism founded on self-ownership, ideas of natural rights we find perhaps in Nozick. And my thought is that maybe there's another, a third way regarding justification at least, a democratic way of finding a reason to give weight, moral weight, to economic liberty.
The problem with any kind of freedom is that those who have certain sorts of benefits through luck or whatever tend to exploit those who don't. Freedom for the pike is death for the minnows, and if the pike are really rich, God help the minnows. How can you avoid that problem, or is it not a problem for you?
Sure. Well, I work within a democratic framework. The democratic framework requires that whatever social structure one affirms, it has to be acceptable to all the citizens who live their lives within that framework. So if a framework works in such a way that the minnows get gobbled up or set back by the interests of the bigger fish, then that structure will fail the test of democratic legitimacy. The main move in free market fairness is to say, well, if we think that economic liberties should be recognized, morally speaking, as among the basic rights and liberties, well, then how do we get distributive justice? And my basic idea is that we need to have a social world in which all citizens can look upon the talents of their fellow citizens as in some sense a common bounty. And if you think about a society that would give incentives to creative people to unleash their creative talents on the world and do so in a way that might lead them to becoming very wealthy individually, the big fish, as you put it, that has to be done in such a way that the minnows grow too. Rawls calls it the difference principle, and I accept something like that. We're looking for a structure which best encourages talented people like Steve Jobs or Wilt Chamberlain, I suppose, to go out there and play the game with all the energy and vigor that they have in a way that doesn't set other people's interests back, but rather moves them all along with them. One of the basic ideas of social justice in the left liberal tradition recently is that fairness is compatible with a certain degree of inequality. You want to have the opportunity, at least, to focus on the least well-off working class. And if that means that we're going to have some inequalities to improve the condition of that class, those inequalities can still be fair.
So Wilt Chamberlain, the basketball player, is entitled to earn a huge salary because the people enjoy watching him and he's superb. But what you were saying sounded a bit like John Rawls anyway, and this notion of the difference principle, the idea that the only condition under which the rich could get much richer is if, as a consequence, the poor are brought up.
Yes, I work within a tradition that I think of as justice as fairness. And you mentioned Rawls. Let me just read a quotation that's a formulation of justice as fairness. We should regard as the most desirable order of society one which we would choose if we knew that our initial position in it would be determined purely by chance, such as the fact of our being born into a particular family. Close quote. It's worth pausing to see the power of that approach to social justice. If you want to know how to organize our society, we might try to figure out a way to model the idea of fairness. So we might imagine parties making a choice about a whole social structure that they're going to live within behind a kind of a veil, which makes them ignorant of all different facts about themselves. And I'm just kind of curious if the quotation I just read, do you happen to know who said that?
Was it John Rawls?
Well, it's interesting that John Rawls did say something very similar, but the quotation I read was actually from 30 years earlier. It's from 1940, and it's actually not from America, but here in London, from a person often thought as being Rawls's great rival. It's Friedrich Hayek. He tells this lovely story about how when he was in London during the bombing in 1940, he had to send his children somewhere, and he started thinking about, well, where will they end up? And he thought he might be killed himself, therefore they don't even have a father of a certain stature to defend them. They could be anyone in that society. And Hayek reports that he began thinking then from that actual experience about the appropriate way to think about a just society. And Hayek came up with something like the original position, an attempt to model fairness by using a veil of ignorance 30 years before Rawls.
The veil of ignorance, this notion that you have to imagine what a good society would be like without actually knowing your own position in that society. So you may end up as somebody with a disability, or you may end up with somebody with super abilities who's able to earn huge amounts of money potentially. And you have to organize a society blind, as it were, to your own position in that society. Now, that's a technique for creating a kind of utopian fair world. You sound as if you're endorsing that whole framework, which to my mind, curtails free markets because it says there are more important things than economic liberty. You need to be concerned about social justice and the position of the worst off.
I think that's quite wrong. Or at least I don't see it that way at all. There was a line familiar from libertarian literature that went something like this. Market outcomes define social justice or just define distributive justice. Whatever emerges through the free choices people make historically, those will count as distributively just simply because they are historically just. But I reject that tradition. I'm working solidly within the democratic tradition. But I also refuse to accept the assumption that seems to be common on the left, that if we think that markets cannot define social justice, therefore we know that markets cannot produce social justice. Obviously, those are two completely different propositions. And I'm interested in the idea that, in fact, markets can produce social justice, can satisfy that external standard of social justice. To work that out, you need to develop a conception of distributive justice. It seems to me that in the last century, we were very lucky to have some brilliant political philosophers developing conceptions of social justice. What we didn't realize at the time, though, in fact, was that these philosophers were merely working within one possible tradition of social justice. This is a tradition that I call social democratic. On that approach to social justice, economic liberties are minimized. The content of the concern that we owe the poor distributionally is given in certain terms that emphasize values such as solidarity and perhaps worker controls of their own workplaces. There's another tradition that I'm trying to explore that I call a market democratic approach to social justice. It's characterized by thinking that ordinary people, or the claims that they care about their own work choices, that they care about their own savings accounts and their own responsibilities in those areas, that those are morally significant claims they're making. Economic liberty should be included on that list of basic rights and liberties. And that also then requires, it seems to me, that we look again about what exactly it is that we owe the least well off. And I think that what we owe the least well off is unambiguously a society that is intended to maximize the bundle of material wealth personally controlled by individuals.
I can understand why it's interesting to foreground economic liberty as a liberty and to focus on that and to suggest that it's been underplayed. But I can't quite understand how that's compatible with treating people with respect generally, because there are threshold levels that people need to live well. And economic freedoms about, for instance, freedom to employ people on a below a minimum wage and so on, are completely counter to that tendency to treat people with dignity, it seems to me.
Yeah, so I think we have to have open discussions about what we think dignity requires. I think people in the Rawlsian tradition, the orthodox Rawlsian tradition, have made a mistake to neglect the moral importance of private economic liberty. I think we should put more weight on economic liberty and on a wider range of economic liberties. Nonetheless, it seems to me that that's compatible with being deeply concerned for the poor, to being committed to social justice, a society that in some instances certainly does provide safety nets, provides support for certain kinds of goods such as public schooling. We shouldn't worry that if we accept the importance of economic liberty, we suddenly can no longer have a state that can do anything. We can have a state that can do quite a bit to protect people in need. And yet we should, I think, be aware of the possibility that, in the ambition of left liberals of the last century to do good for people, they treated them with a certain kind of economic paternalism that was not truly respectful of people. And there's an analogy with feminism. In the 1800s, many feminist pioneers argued that being provided with goods, all the material means in the world, but being denied economic liberties, was just a fundamentally bad thing to have done to women. And until women were recognized as economic equals in terms of their rights, something's fundamentally wrong is being done to them, no matter how much stuff they were given.
Any liberty is constrained in some way to be a liberty rather than purely license. License is being allowed to do anything whatsoever. I'm free to do all kinds of things, but it's not right that I should be free to kill you, for instance. In the world of free markets, you could still have a free market by some definition, which restricts the minimum wage. It says, look, this is the least you can pay somebody. Would you defend that view?
I'm skeptical. We need to work out philosophically together about what exactly the boundaries of self-authorship are that are respective of economic liberty. There are many economic issues which seem to me cannot plausibly be claimed to touch the core of respecting people as responsible self-authors. But there is an important range, I think a much wider range than is commonly recognized, of economic choices and economic decisions that are parts of our moral self-authorship. Liberties of working, not just the right to decide which occupation you pursue, but also a pretty substantial right to decide the terms in which one works for oneself. People define themselves in many ways by the choices they make about work, how many hours they spend to devote to earning money, how many hours they devote to family and friends, what part of their mind is placed on these economic strivings, what parts are placed on other kinds of issues in their lives. That's the very stuff of life for many people. And regarding the minimum wage that you mentioned, I'm just skeptical of the idea that people should be constrained in that way. I think people should be able to decide for themselves what wages they're willing to work for and on what terms.
Well, if I'm starving and somebody offers me a piece of bread for a day's work, that may look like good terms, but it's not treating me with dignity and respect.
Yeah, I certainly agree. There has to be a baseline. A decent society, a decent democratic society, has to provide publicly, if it needs be, for all citizens. No one should starve in the streets in a wealthy society, and it wouldn't be fair if they did. And the conception of free market fairness that I'm describing is one which is very enthusiastic about markets, very enthusiastic about capitalism, properly understood, but nonetheless thinks, like the classical liberals, that there's a very important role for the state to be sure that no one starves and that everyone has an education, for example.
Maybe if I've misunderstood your position, but could it be redescribed as what Rawls should have said if he'd given adequate weight to markets?
I think of it as what Hayek should have said if he'd given a little more attention to social justice, and also what Rawls would have said and maybe should have said if he'd given a little more weight to economic liberty.
What would be the practical implications if governments took your philosophy seriously?
I'm not so good on practical on practical implications. My main project is to try to identify the morally appropriate way for people to live together. But I do think an important implication is this. When philosophers set out these moral ideals, I see us as sort of setting up stars in the sky or pointing to stars in the sky. They define normative ambitions for us. And many people, I think, in America certainly, they think that morality points strongly in the direction of the left, that there's a star above the European social democracies hanging in the sky up there. There really is the kind of society we all should be working toward if we can only get there. And if you want to make our own societies more socially just, we should work to make them more like the European social democracies. I think that's quite wrong. I think there is a star above the European social democracies that is attractive and that Rawls was right to pick out as being something significant. But I think there's a much higher star, a star that hangs, ironically perhaps, above North America, someplace above New York perhaps. And that star is committed to economic liberty, committed to respecting those attitudes of everyday working people, the importance to them of their own economic lives, is also foundationally committed to social justice. And I call it free market fairness, but you can call it something less formal, social justice, American style.
John Tomasi, thank you very much.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you, Nigel. Thank you, David.
There's now a Philosophy Bites book published by Oxford University Press. For more information, go to www.philosophybites.com.
For more information about the Institute, go to www.philosophy.sas.ac.uk.